Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 50 years ago, then-Senator Robert Kennedy visited South Africa. It was a time of major upheaval over apartheid, and he had been invited by the National Union of African Students. Bobby Kennedy took to the podium at the University of Cape Town and delivered what many historians say is one of his greatest speeches.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others, or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
The speech inspired many, including anti-apartheid student activist and future Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Margaret Marshall. And while Bobby Kennedy is often idolized for his leadership on progressive goals that defined the 1960s, he didn't start as a liberal icon. Kennedy was an ardent Cold Warrior, but as Larry Tye writes in his new biography, RFK's transformation on key issues such as civil rights mirrored the transformation of the nation as a whole. The book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, and Larry Tye joins us now from WCAI in Woods Hole. Larry, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you.
So Larry, first of all, I want to start off with the question of how you got so much new insight into Robert Kennedy, and part of that has to do with access, because you spoke with a lot of people who were very close to Bobby Kennedy, and many of them had never even spoken to another biographer before.
Lots of people talked because I think they were sensing their own mortality, that Bobby would have turned 90 this year, Ethel, his wife, turned 88, and I think lots of people realized it was me or nobody, and so I talked to probably between 400 and 450 people. The good news was they were terrific. Ethel was wonderful. Her kids were really helpful. Lots of people I talked to were telling stories they said for the first time, partly because there were no Kennedy protectors around to sort of circle the wagons, and as I say, partly because they felt they were getting older and sensing their vulnerability. The good news is all those people talked to me. The bad news is, in just the couple of years that I've been working on the book, somewhere between a quarter and a third of the people I talked to have gone in that time.
Well, so let's hear from you a little bit about then what Ethel Kennedy told you, because as you said, she hasn't really spoken to anybody else about Bobby Kennedy. So what did she tell you that most surprised you?
So she was incredibly candid. Lots of things over the years have come up that various Kennedy defenders have tried to airbrush out of Bobby's record, like the fact that he started out as an aide to Senator Joe McCarthy. This was in an era when America was worried about communism, when Bobby Kennedy was exceedingly worried about communism, and when he thought that Joe McCarthy was one of the few guys who had the courage to stand up and take on communist threats, not just overseas, but allegedly in our own government. And lots of people, as I say, had been reluctant to have that as part of the record of this liberal icon. Ethel was wonderfully candid in talking about how Joe Kennedy and Joe McCarthy were great friends, and how Joe McCarthy was a great friend of her husband Bobby's.
Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but this gets to the heart of the story about Bobby Kennedy that you tell in the biography, about this transformation from, you know, him having a great regard for Joe McCarthy to being that liberal icon that we all know so very well today. And in fact, you write that a lot of people don't even want to acknowledge how important, for example, that early time that he spent with McCarthy was, some 7.5 months in 1953. I mean, how did that influenced Bobby Kennedy?
It was the first real job that he had ever had. It was somebody that he had tremendous respect for in terms of McCarthy, and he went out and did some of the best investigations the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations ever did. And so it was an enormous influence on him, both in terms of McCarthy being a mentor in that era, in terms of reinforcing the anti-communist views that he had grown up with in Joe Kennedy's household, and in terms of sort of setting him on a path that many would call ruthless in terms of his own personal interactions in that era. The press decided that this was a very smart guy, it was a very tough guy, and it was a very conservative guy that they were dealing with in the Bobby Kennedy of the 1950s.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Joe Kennedy and his relationship with McCarthy, because you write in the book that Bobby, in a certain way, was a lot like his father, that he saw the world in very black and white terms, which made him different from his brother John Kennedy, who had a more nuanced view. I mean, was that one of the fundamental differences between them?
It was. So if I could tell you a quick story.
Please.
At the funeral of Joe McCarthy, lots of conservative senators and congressmen went to the funeral, and Bobby Kennedy flew to that funeral on the same plane that all of them did. John Kennedy, who was a young senator who knew he wanted to be president someday, understood that it would not be something that he'd want on his political record, having showed up at Joe McCarthy's funeral. What Bobby Kennedy did was let all the dignitaries get off the plane. Then when everybody had left the airport, he got off the plane, hitched a ride to the funeral with a reporter, sat up in the balcony and stood quietly at the graveside, and essentially he was showing two things. On the one hand, he had sworn all the reporters he ran into there to secrecy that he had been there, because he knew that it was controversial being there. On the other hand, he wanted to stand up and say, I'm loyal to this guy. This guy gave me my first job. He's somebody I believed in, and that's a part of my life that I don't want to deny, and that's something his brother Jack would never have dreamed of doing.
Huh. So when do we start seeing this transformation or this evolution towards the more progressive liberal champion that people look back and remember Bobby Kennedy as being? I mean, did it come before or after, say, he was sworn in as Attorney General in 61?
It came during his Attorney General era. He started out as somebody on an issue, let's just take the issue of civil rights. He started out as somebody who didn't know a whole lot about civil rights when he went into the job, and he started out pretty clueless in dealing with the early civil rights disturbances that as Attorney General he had to deal with. When the Freedom Riders were going across the South, young black and white college students largely, going and trying to integrate interstate transportation, and they met up with violence, Bobby Kennedy did not react decisively. He wanted to, on the one hand, protect them, and on the other hand, he really wanted them to go away. He didn't want them to be an embarrassment to his brother, the president, especially as the president was having a summit with Nikita Khrushchev, and he didn't want us to be embarrassed overseas by having these racial problems. He didn't quite understand them. But over time, he had to deal with every civil rights controversy that happened in the early 1960s, from the stand in the schoolhouse door that George Wallace took to try to keep blacks out of the University of Alabama, to the race riots at the University of Mississippi at Ole Miss. And Bobby was in the center of those. And in that situation, like in everything throughout his life, he learned, he grew as he experienced things, and every new experience, he was a little more nuanced in dealing with it, to the point where at the end of his attorney generalship, he was on the cutting edge of civil rights issues, and by the end of his life, he was probably the most popular white man in black America.
Huh. And so I'm wondering what drove that. I mean, was part of it that, I mean, this is the transformation that you write about in the book was also similar to the upheaval and transformation that America itself was experiencing at the time. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a foregone conclusion. And of course, in the middle of all this, his brother is assassinated as well. So I'm just wondering, like, was there a point at which, you know, Robert Kennedy had to make a choice in sort of what kind of person he wanted to be?
So that's a great question. And the answer is the tough side and the tender side were both there from the beginning. And they just, in different measures, came out in different ways over the years. He started out very tough, and only the people who were very close to him, like Ethel, saw the tenderness. By the end, the country saw the tenderness, and that's why he seemed on the verge of winning the presidential nomination of his party and maybe the presidency. And I think the critical event in between the early and the ending Bobby Kennedy was the death of his brother. That when Jack Kennedy was shot, Bobby Kennedy was the most stalwart of any of his family members and maybe the most stalwart person in the country in sort of getting things done that needed to be done. Jack had to be buried. There had to be a transition. All the things, the difficult things that fall on somebody in the family fell on Bobby Kennedy because he was the closest to his brother and he was the attorney general. He was the one in the family, in the seat of power, who could really dictate what was going on. So for the first month or two, he was really holding things together, even though inside he had lost his best friend, he had lost his closest work companion. And yet, when the country started finally getting it together again and stopped mourning the president who was gone, Bobby fell apart. He had what I think today we would call clinical depression and went through a period of 6 or 7 months of just not sure of what he wanted to do in the world and being unclear whether he was ever going to sort of get a sense of purpose again.
Right.
And it was only very slowly that he started not only pulling it together himself, but sort of giving play to the tender side. He started reading Greek tragedies. He started understanding that life wasn't always one victory and one sort of hard-headed drive after another. And he saw just how vulnerable he and his family were, and a very different Bobby Kennedy started emerging at that point.
Right. I mean, speaking of Greek tragedy, he quotes Aeschylus, right, later on when he had to talk about the death of Dr. Martin Luther King. But you, Larry, have some really incredible insight into this specific period in Robert Kennedy's life due to the people who spoke with you. And you were very kind enough to share some of the interviews that you conducted for the book with us, some of the tape from those interviews. So I want to just play a little bit from Kennedy aide and confidant John Siegenthaler, whom you talked to. And he told you about, you know, after JFK's assassination, about walking into Bobby's office one day, and he saw Bobby Kennedy sitting in the dark, getting a haircut.
He looks awful. He's lost weight. He said, "How do I look?" And I said, "You look like hell." And he said, I can't sleep. Sort of hollow cheeks. Most of all, pain. I mean, his face was really sort of etched in pain.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what Siegenthaler told you?
Sure. Let me tell you a little bit about who Siegenthaler was. Siegenthaler was characteristic of the kind of people who were attracted to Bobby Kennedy. He was one of the hardest-hitting journalists in the American South. He was the editor of the Nashville Tennessean and the mentor to all the great Southern journalists, from Tom Wicker to David Halberstam to lots of great journalists from that era. And yet, he fell in love with Bobby Kennedy. He was his aide at the Justice Department, and probably for the rest of his life, he was Bobby's closest friend. And the first thing I did when I signed the book contract was jumped on a plane to Nashville to talk to John Siegenthaler. I knew he had colon cancer. I wasn't sure how long he was going to be around, and I ended up sitting down with him for 7 hours because he had extraordinary insight into especially that period of that clinical depression and just how he was one of the people, along with Ethel, who helped pull Bobby out of it.
Hmm. I mean, he must have felt profoundly that the mantle had now come to him, that the work that his brother had begun was obviously tragically cut short, and he took the obligation to continue that seriously.
He did, because he had been brought up that way. Joe Kennedy had been very explicit with each of his kids. When Joe Jr. died, it was made clear to Jack that he was the one who was up next and he was going to be the president. When Jack died, it wasn't that very night that Jack died. It was communicated to Bobby that this was the expectation, that he was next in line. And there was just this sense, Joe had very high expectations for his kids. He wanted them, ideally, all to be in the White House. And Bobby had the mantle passed to him in a familial sense like that. And he also had this sense, personally, as he was reading these Greek tragedies, he also had the sense that he could emerge again as a more tender but also as a heroic figure and pick up all the causes that he and Jack had believed in. Only I think Bobby was actually more passionate about lots of issues like civil rights, more willing to be provocative, and might have been a more interesting and effective president. We have been, I think, for the last 50 years, looking for the perfect combination of tough, liberal, or tender conservative that I think Bobby represented.
Okay, so tell me more about that, because, of course, he was assassinated in 1968. What a terrible year in U.S. history. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy in the same year. You know, when we think about this transformation that you've been talking about and the tough but tender liberalism that Kennedy, RFK, championed, I mean, does it help you sort of consider what America is looking for in its leadership today?
It hugely does today. And so let me just give you an example of what I was talking about with that tough liberal. The night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, Bobby was campaigning for president in the state of Indiana, and he was in Indianapolis. And he was due to give a speech in the middle of the black ghetto in Indianapolis. And the mayor, a guy who went on to become a senator named Richard Lugar, and the police chief said, "You can't go there." And Bobby said, "You can't tell me I can't go there." And he went there. The police escort let him off partway there, and he went into the middle of the black ghetto. He gave a speech where people I interviewed who were there said there were people there with knives and Molotov cocktails, and nobody was sure that they wanted this white politician in their midst. He told half of them for the first time that Martin Luther King had been shot and killed. And he went on for the first time in his life to talk publicly about what his brother's death had been like with him and how angry he had been. And he said, "We can't let our anger get the best of us. If anybody in the world can appreciate the anger you're feeling today, it is me. But we have to control our anger." And it turned out that one of the only cities in the entire country that did not have race riots the night of Martin Luther King's death was Indianapolis, where Bobby Kennedy had helped calm people down.
Well, that's Larry Tye, author of the new biography, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's set to be released on July 5th. Larry, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
It was great being with you. Thank you.
And by the way, I mentioned Aeschylus, and Larry was talking about the speech that Robert Kennedy gave on the night of Martin Luther King's death. And the end of that poem that Kennedy quoted says, "Against our will comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.